Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth and Movies. I'm Michael Leader.
And I'm Leila Lateef.
And I'm Hannah Strong.
And today we'll be talking about John Krasinski's suspenseful thriller, Quiet Place Part 2, the innovative, intimate hoggumentary, Gunda, and in Film Club, we're trotting back to 1998 for George Miller's Babe, Pig in the City, all coming up on Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Yes, welcome listeners and welcome Leila. It's been a while. How have you been?
I've been good. I've just been kind of, you know, bacchanalian hedonism in the sunshine, skipping around from pub garden to cinema screening and loving life.
So since we've done this revamp of the podcast, going back to weekly episodes, we're using that as an opportunity to reintroduce all our regular contributors. So Leila, what have you been up to recently, work-wise, that we can go and read?
I got to contribute to the Little White Lies greatest ever video nasties list, which was really good fun. Lots of serial killers and naked ladies and naked lady serial killers, which was a real hoot. And then I've got a lovely episode of Inside Cinema coming up in a couple of weeks on June 23rd, which everyone can look out for.
Mm-hmm. Yes, excellent. And Hannah, you were on last week, so we're up to date with you. But at that point, had you been to the cinema as a paying punter? Have you been yet?
Yeah, I've been loads. I'm just trying to remember. I think 6 times now.
Oof.
I'm going to get on Friday. Can't get me out of the screens. It's ridiculous.
What's the best thing you've seen so far?
Not to be basic, but 2001: A Space Odyssey. I think we may have talked about this last week because it blew my mind. It was really good. Sorry, the Prince Charles on 70 mil, unrestored print to get all cinema bro, but no, it was really, really good. Had a great time, was glad I waited.
Mm-hmm. And Leila, you've been enjoying the sun. Have you been enjoying the air-conditioned confines of the cinema much in the last couple of weeks?
I think much like many people, it was exciting when summer arrived, and then by day two I wanted to go and sit in the dark.
Perfect. And we've got plenty of new releases to talk about for more people who want to go and sit in the dark. Up first, we should have Bated Breath, a charged silence for A Quiet Place Part 2. So a bit of setup for A Quiet Place Part 2. Following the deadly events at home, the Abbott family must now face the terrors of the outside world as they continue their fight for survival in silence. Forced to venture into the unknown, they quickly realise that the creatures that hunt by sound are not the only threats that lurk beyond the sand path. So, A Quiet Place Part 2, a post-apocalyptic movie that almost became our post-apocalyptic movie, because that was one of the last films that was due to come out before lockdown happened last year. I remember it was the film that was on the sides of buses for months across spring and summer 2020. And now it's finally come out. Finally getting its cinema bow. Leila, was it worth the wait?
I think the first 20 minutes were certainly worth the wait. We start with the action as the alien invasion kind of happens, and it, you know, articulates exactly how it all went down. I think a lot of us assumed that they were aliens, but, you know, now we know for sure because we see them kind of crashing through the atmosphere. And that, like, great chaos on this, like, normal Rockwell, really idyllic town is really great fun. And then we cut to essentially the moment that the last film ends. And from then on, I it really I thought it was pretty disappointing for the most part after that. Like, it actually is very inert, especially one of the major threads that's going through. The family kind of divides into two, and one of them just sort of end up in this like cyclical stasis where like nothing kind of moves them forward, and in fact they kind of seem to keep going backwards. You know, John Kerensky, spoilers for The Quiet Place One, isn't with us anymore, but he does appear in the flashback, and he's sort of replaced by Cillian Murphy as a new father figure, playing basically the exact same character. I mean, in my head, I just named them Sad Dad One and Sad Dad Two. But they, you know, they have the same sort of like depression beard and the same kind of relationship to everyone, in that the whole thing with the first one is that John Kerensky is continually underestimating his daughter and thinking that she's really not brave enough and strong enough to go and do things on her own. And then Cillian Murphy comes along and kind of does the exact same thing. And she keeps saying to him, you know, you're nothing like my dad. And I'm just, was just like, he's exactly like your dad, like to an uncanny degree. It's one of those weird films, though, that even though I wasn't impressed by it, I'd kind of recommend it. Because like the sound design of it was really cool. It's a really fun 97 minutes. There's some good set pieces. And seeing it in the cinema with all kind of like the the cool sound elements that they have, and, you know, silence followed by screeching monsters, was actually a really nice moment for being back in the cinema. So, you know, mixed bag.
Watching this film made me think a lot about interviews that John Krasinski made at the time of the release of the first film, where he just released this film that was being very much marketed as a jump scare horror film. And he said, you know, I'm not really a horror guy. I don't really make, you know, this is, I don't see this as a horror film. And I don't, that shows more in the second one, that he doesn't really have much of a horror filmmaker toolkit. He only really has one trick, and that's Spielbergian suspense, using sound design and long drawn out moments, as you say, Layla, and then the dawning realization of something awful that's going to happen. But he doesn't really have anything else up his sleeve. And I suppose it's just a pure case of sequelitis. I don't think A Quiet Place, when they first made it, they had the idea of making more, but then it was a surprise hit, wasn't it? Hannah, what did you make of the sequel?
Yeah, I think that the problem is the idea of these monsters who navigate by sound. It can't really sustain itself. Certainly not the way that John Krasinski's telling the story. I did enjoy the first one. I think actually the funniest thing about the first one for me was that I watched it in a packed cinema in Hackney, and everyone kind of goes into a horror film clutching their popcorn. And this is a film where like you can't really eat popcorn because it totally destroys the ambience. So everyone was trying to like eat their popcorn either super, super quietly or to like do it really quickly when the monsters came on screen. So that is very funny to me. And actually at the press screening for A Quiet Place 2, they gave us all bags of marshmallows, which I thought was really, really funny. I thought that was like a hilarious joke, but no one else seemed to agree with me that was very funny. I was saying to everyone, they gave us marshmallows, do you get it? Because it's A Quiet Place. And everyone was just not very amused by that. But yeah, I kind of was hoping that they could pick up from the last film and kind of go in a new direction. But I actually think the film pretty much follows the exact plot of the first film. There's some foot-based trauma. There's, like Layla said, the kind of sad dad underestimating the plucky young girl. And then essentially, like, I don't really think this is a spoiler, but it kind of even, like, ends in the same way. It's just very repetitive, and people have said like, oh, it's clear that they were doing a lot of world building for the sequel because there's going to be another one somewhere down the line. But I can't even really see what the sequel would be about. There's no sense for me of where any of this is going. They seem to be at the end of The Quiet Place Part Two in exactly the same place they were at the beginning of the film. So yeah, I don't know, I'm just very like underwhelmed. And also, yes, you said about Krasinski not having a kind of horror background. This massively shows for me in his kind of like understanding of the post-apocalyptic world, because it very much throws me out of the moment when I'm watching a post-apocalyptic horror film and the heroine has like perfect hair. Because like, where is Emily Blunt finding a hairdresser to do her highlights when they're like 18 months post collapse? That for me, like, it just really angered me.
You're right. I think, not to rag too much on John Krasinski, because I feel like whenever I criticise him, it's just his character from The Office looking sad. But he's not a speculative storyteller in terms of the speculative fiction. He doesn't really think about the implications of this post-apocalyptic world. We do go outside the family homestead from the first film, which was such a good contained area where the outside world may as well not exist. But once you start looking to other survivors, other little hubs of a new civilization or society, it is quite thinly drawn. So the idea that he's sketching out a world for a sequel, it's not quite successful here. But we should say, you know, Emily Blunt was such a strong presence in the first one. She takes a bit more of a back seat here, not just to Cillian Murphy, who, as you say, Layla, is doing a very good sad dad performance. But we should shout out Millicent Simmons. I feel like a stuck record because it's almost the exact same praise we gave the last one. She's so good as the young daughter, and is again carrying so much of this film. Layla, what about the performances for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think Millicent Simmons is wonderful, and I'm kind of glad that they're sort of positioning her as like the Ripley, I suppose, of the franchise. But it's all a bit thin, isn't it? I mean, when you think of all of these elements, when they sort of try to bring in this idea of like, ooh, people might be the real monsters after all, they sort of pick up the idea, but they don't examine it or do anything with it. And I've also really felt that was the case with the monsters, because for sure in the first one, we could kind of skate by on like, oh, this concept of sound and like, you know, they've got these cool long limbs and stuff. But I just found myself a lot of the time being like, yeah, but what are these guys? Like, they're not eating people. So they're just assholes, essentially. They just like, rip things to pieces. And like, you think like the great monsters of, you know, of time, there has to kind of be a bit of like theory behind them to kind of make them interesting. Like, you know, this was like the xenomorphs in Alien and that whole thing of like reproduction, or like that they're kind of doing things as a tool. And with this one, I think we needed a few more ideas and like a few more ideas developed properly.
And you know, the third one, it's already announced that Jeff Nichols, of Midnight Special fame, Take Shelter, you know, he's going to take the reins of the franchise, and he's someone who definitely does know how to turn these high concepts into some deeper ideas to explore character, explore more social themes, I suppose. So I suppose, will it win me back over with that one? I don't know. Would you be turning up for Quiet Place Part 3, Hannah?
I will, because I really love Jeff Nichols and I'm always kind of campaigning for him to make more movies. I can't say the idea of him doing a Quiet Place Part 3 really, like, you know, sparks joy. But I'll definitely, Millicent Simmons, I definitely want to see more from. I felt a bit disappointed by how little Noah Jupe's given to do, because I think he's a great actor. And again, like, him and Emily Blunt really get a kind of a raw deal in this film. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I do appreciate that we are kind of in a bit of a dearth for original horror. So I'll take kind of what I can get at the moment.
Okay, well, let's put some scores on A Quiet Place Part 2. This is in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect. Layla, what are your scores?
I would say in anticipation, I was at a 4 because, you know, I've just... so desperate to get to the cinema to see anything. And like you said, it has been being advertised to us for what feels like decades. Enjoyment, I would give it a 3. You know, screechy monsters, always a joy. But yeah, 2 in retrospect. It was really a bit thin on the ground. And like you said before, that it was just a complete non-ending of a film. So it was quite a deflated feeling at the end.
Hannah?
Probably a 3, just because I think I'd kind of got fatigue from hearing about this film for so long. And then a 2. Yeah, it's just not, it was just disappointing. Like Layla said, I think it, you know, they're really was potential in this one to kind of explore the origins of these creatures and kind of work out where the world is kind of going next. But yeah, it didn't really do any of what I would hope a sequel would do.
Yeah, I think I had residual excitement about the first film because the first film at least had freshness on its side. So probably 3-2-2 for me. There's a glimmer of hope there for Jeff Nichols, particularly if he brings in either of his regular sad dads, Michael Shannon or Joel Edgerton. I imagine they could blow the previous sad dads out of the water.
I would so love to see Michael Shannon shushing someone.
Oh yeah. Okay, yeah. If Michael Shannon like gets on board, yeah, I'm back. I'll be first in line.
So that is A Quiet Place Part 2 in cinemas this weekend. Up next, a very different kind of film. It's Gunda.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Experiential cinema in its purest form, Gunda chronicles the unfiltered lives of a mother pig, a flock of chickens, and a herd of cows with masterful intimacy. Using stark black and white cinematography and the farm's ambient soundtrack, Viktor Kotakovsky invites the audience to slow down and experience life as his subjects do, taking in their world with patience and an otherworldly perspective. So, Hannah, this film has the unique honour of being exec produced by Joaquin Phoenix. The trailer is trailed by a big hype quote from Paul Thomas Anderson, but Matt Turner of Little White Lies broke the perfect Rotten Tomatoes score for this film. Hannah, what should you make of Gunda? And please introduce us to the world of Gunda.
I'm not sure I can, really. I was kind of excited for this because I like a good animal movie. I particularly like a good pig movie, as we'll get onto later in our film club. But and this had been really hyped to me as well. I'd obviously read about Joaquin Phoenix exec producing and kind of, you know, been this big like film about kind of highlighting the quiet dignity of the humble pig, and you know, kind of making people realize, I guess, that animals are kind of nice. Like, I don't know. I don't really understand why people were so kind of awestruck by this on the festival circuit, because I was incredibly bored. And I initially thought, when I saw Matt Turner's review, I thought, oh, well, it's entirely possible Matt, as like a documentary expert, is just kind of having some like nitpicking issues. But actually, no, I think Matt is onto something. I think it's very, I don't know, like, I want to say it's like Tarkovsky does a film about a pig, but purely because of like the aesthetics of like this, you know, very beautiful black and white cinematography. But yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'm just a kind of a Philistine, but I really could not kind of get on board with 90 minutes of just watching a pig kind of go about its business. I liked the chicken though. The chicken, this one-legged chicken who you sort of see hopping around the farm, is good fun. But I think like I get the concept, but I just don't, I think it's probably not the best film to watch at home on your TV, because you just can drift very easily and start thinking like, oh, I should make a shopping list. Oh, I should, you look up that recipe for roast pork that I've been meaning to look at. You know, I just think it's probably one that would benefit from like the kind of the dark sensory deprivation booth of the cinema. And maybe that's why I didn't kind of get on with it, because I think it's just... I don't want to keep saying I was bored, but I really was. I was so bored. I texted a friend of mine who'd already seen it, and I said, is it just a pig for 90 minutes? And he was like, yeah, pretty much. And once I kind of realized it was just going to be 90 minutes of watching a farm, I think I kind of maybe tuned out a little bit.
It's funny, isn't it? We talk about this every now and then when a documentary comes on the podcast. Every year we have a handful of breakout, I mean, I'm using this word maybe as a concept, blockbuster documentaries, which get the bigger push than most of the festival fare. And that's why it's sometimes very instructive to read a review like the one that Matt Turner's written, because he's somebody who is watching documentaries day in, day out. And these observational, human element-free documentaries are dime a dozen on the festival circuit, but only some of them get exec produced by Joaquin Phoenix and pushed to as many screens as this one. So does that extra exposure, when people lose their minds with the raves about this, saying how it's a transcendent piece of filmmaking, does that lessen it at all? Or is it just, you know, because you're jaded and you've seen so many documentaries at this stage? You know, Hannah, I asked last week about First Cow. Was the cow metaphorical? And now I'm going to be asking if the pig is metaphorical in Gunda. And Viktor Kosakowski in interviews talks a big game. You know, he made the film Aquarella a few years ago, which was very much looking at climate change through a documentary that's only about bodies of water. And now this is very much about the impact on the environment of the industrialized farming industry. And it's very easy to watch this and not really get that when in the interviews he's talking about how in 2020 we killed billions of pigs, billions of chickens, trillions of fish just to feed the meat eaters of the world. And that's the impact. And so how could we as filmmakers even consider making something will they, won't they romance film in this sort of context? So he talks a big game and then makes this film that could very much just pass by in an hour and a half. Layla, where do you land on Gunda? Was this, were you sent on a transcendent journey, or were you bored like Hannah was?
I wasn't bored, and I was amazed that I wasn't bored, because I kind of started and it was like, oh wow, this is like really beautifully done. Like this cinematography is like, it's very, very crisp and very like steely black and whites, which I appreciated because I hate a kind of sludgy black and white. And then about 10 minutes in, I was just like, surely not. This can't be it for like 90 minutes. But I sort of fell into like a relaxed rhythm with it. And then the ending really hit me. And I actually ended up really liking Gunda. I was quite surprised by it. Like I've got two small children, and there was something like that. It really took me back to having newborns, particularly with this pig and her little piglets. And I used to always joke about how when you're a new mother, it's a bit like having a tiny gummy zombie in your house, that there's like all of a sudden there's this being that's like entirely carnivorous towards you. And it's just like you'll look over and they'll just be like nibbling on your elbow or something, because it's very strange to become a food source. And like, I really felt that like Gunda captured that feeling for me. And like a lot of like feelings of early motherhood, I quite connected to with this like very expressive little pig. And, you know, sort of the tragedy of pigs is they're only really farmed for one thing. So there's only one way that this can end up. I suppose maybe there's one pig out there who's like making hog's hair brushes or something, but the rest of them, it's the same sad fate. So yeah, I mean, I ended up really being quite moved by it in the end, but I was surprised by that, because yeah, 10 minutes in, I was like, surely not, this isn't just the pig.
I will highlight that the ending as well, as you know, we said that Quiet Place Part Two might have had a bit of a limp ending, but this one Gunda does come together in an emotional way that maybe if you were lulled into this patient, ambient, easygoing feeling for the rest of the film, you'd be surprised by. So stick with it to the end if you are watching it. Don't walk out after 45 minutes. But should we put some scores on Gunda? Hannah, I'll come to you first.
It's probably a 4 in anticipation. I think, yeah, I was kind of attracted by the good reviews, but also Matt's dissenting take, just because I was, you know, there was a pure curiosity factor. And I do, you know, I like seeing cute animals kind of go about their business. And I do think the animals are cute. The pigs are cute. The piglets are very, very cute. And I do agree that the ending, I think, is very good. But to me, it just doesn't really justify the kind of 90 minutes that I spent just watching cows wander around. Also, I grew up in the countryside, so like I've seen like cows. One of my uncles is a farmer, so I think maybe that it was kind of like preaching to the choir a little bit. I don't know. Like a 2 and a 2. It just wasn't for me, but I definitely could appreciate the kind of cinematography and the artistry that's gone into it. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't get on with it.
Layla.
It's probably a 3 coming into it. Like, I'd had a good buzz, but I find Joaquin Phoenix slightly unbearable at times. Probably a 3 in terms of enjoyment, but then 4 in retrospect, because, you know, I just found a lot of it quite moving in the end.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'd probably say maybe 4, 3, 3 for me. This is the sort of film that I do love catching on the festival circuit, particularly documentary festivals, but it didn't really convince beyond what I'd seen elsewhere. The work of like Nicholas Gerhalter, for example. And I suppose that's a good way of looking at it right now, is that maybe some of the mainstream films coming to cinemas, the blockbusters, are under-delivering, so it's a time for curiosity and discovery and going off the beaten track. And maybe something like Gundam may open your eyes to a whole world of observational, experiential documentary, and there's a lot out there with festivals like Sheffield Doc Fest just around the corner, and plenty of opportunities to try and watch it. But sounds like from Hannah, it's more like Gunyet than Gunda, but a bit more positive from Layla. Listeners, if you do catch either A Quiet Place Part 2 or Gunda in cinemas this weekend, let us know what you think at the usual channels. That's at LW Lies on Twitter, or at truthandmovies@tcolondon.com via email. So Layla, you mentioned about there must be one pig out there who's escaping from the certain fate that they have on the farm. And we're going to talk about that very pig next in Film Club. It's Babe, Pig in the City. This sequel to the Oscar-winning, heartwarming 1995 blockbuster takes Babe, the sheep pig, on a crusade into the midst of a large city where, despite incredible obstacles, he's able to turn enemies into friends, raise enough money to save the farm, and combine the two worlds into one. And once again, it's Babe's kind and steady heart that achieves miracles. So this is one of those strange films that don't get made anymore. Babe, back in 1995, unexpected, huge hit, Oscar contender. Then George Miller, who produced and co-wrote that film, takes the reins and makes a very bizarre film that was a huge box office flop and pretty much chased George Miller away from live action filmmaking for nearly 2 decades until he made Mad Max Fury Road in 2015. Layla, had you seen this film before? Do you have much of an ongoing relationship with Babe?
Yeah, I mean, I think I saw it when it first came out, I hadn't revisited it since. It's very strange. I mean, I think it's kind of a bit of a boring thing to say that things have aged badly, because virtually nothing ages well. It was pretty... It was much stranger than I had kind of remembered it, as sequels go. Like, it's complete, like, virtually no one really returns from the first one, where they kind of make brief cameos at the beginning. And then it's a whole new set of animals and a whole new set of animal performers. And I just feel that the animal performer is such an uncomfortable thing in a 2021 lens. Mm-hmm. And in particular, that there's like an element of, and they are in the film performing animals for the most part. And then there's this wonderful bit at the end where they all don't have to be performing animals anymore, and they get to kind of live their lives, you know, in freedom. And I was just like, oh, but that's not what's happened to the actual animals in this film. And yeah, the whole thing just seemed a bit grim to me, if I'm honest. Like, it starts with this weird kind of Final Destination style accident for the farmer. And then there's just sort of like a bit of a lot more darkness than I remembered. Like, there's sort of dogs that almost drown. There's a lot of kind of blue jokes about people being fugly and yelling at a cat that it's a pussy and stuff. And I was just like, what is this? This is just kind of a kind of weird fever dream of, it took me two goes to get through it. I just, I did not have a good time with Babe 2.
It's wild in both the positive and negative senses, I think, really. George Miller, you forget that George Miller has this almost cartoonish sensibility with his filmmaking, where it's there's this off-kilter but very fast pace to many of his set pieces and sequences. Of course, he immediately takes Babe out of the context that he was in the first film, this lovely, you know, idyllic farm setting, and throws him into almost a Terry Gilliam film. The way that they create this metropolis that is all major cities in one, and then this hotel for performing animals, and then there's a heist. It's a very simple plot. There's stories behind the scenes how about half an hour was cut out of this film. For many reasons, particularly, as you said, Layla, it's way too dark and violent. I think it, even on its first certification, the theatrical cut was given a PG, which is not really what you want for your kid's pig movie. And it still stands as something that is such an odd trip down memory lane of what could get made, but also the crazy filmmakers who were working at that time. So Hannah, you said you love a good pig movie. Is this a good pig movie for you?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I am firmly in the pro Babe Pig in the City camp. And Babe, I think Babe is the greatest Oscar winner we never had. I think it was done dirty. But I love Babe Pig in the City. I think it is a totally mad film that would not get made today, not least because there are no more performing chimps in Hollywood, which is a good thing. I'm not advocating for a return to chimp acting. I think it's a good thing that they've been replaced by CGI. But I'm fascinated by the world of performing animals and have been for quite some time. Just because there's such a long history of this in kind of globally, but within cinema, you know, some of the earliest films made were about kind of performing dogs and things. And obviously, I think it is slightly different when it's dogs and cats and domesticated animals compared to something like a chimpanzee or an orangutan. But yeah, I think this is a very sad kind of oddly depressing film for children with lots of very like scarring moments in it. Like Layla said, the accident at the beginning is like quite horrific. There's a good like few minutes where you think that poor Farmer Hoggett has croaked it. And then later on, the scene where the little British bulldog or some sort of bulldog nearly drowns and Babe has to save them. And there's a little Jack Russell who's disabled and has a little like wheelchair. It's just a very like, only from the mind of George Miller could this film exist. And I kind of appreciate that total sort of commitment to his vision and the fact that he, you know, clearly must have seen how successful Babe was and then thought, well, I'll come and do my take on it this time, you know, do it with my pure directorial vision. And the public said no. You know, I think it's such a fascinating product of its time. And there are loads of kind of things in it that I think are very funny, like the fact that in the hotel all the cats are sort of confined to one room and you can just hear them singing like throughout the film. And at one point they're talking about how there's not enough food to go around. And I think it's Babe who says, oh, if only there weren't so many cats. It's just like, what? It's just, there's so many kind of strange, like one-liners, bits of just absolute surrealism that I really, really enjoy. And I think that kids' movies should strive to be as kind of strange and weird as this. I don't think we're getting the kind of the Babes and the, you know, the whole Don Bluth kind of genre of children's movies where there is a low-key element of terror, but there is obviously a lot of kind of thought and love that's gone into the kind of production too. And I don't think anyone could accuse George Miller of like not putting his whole chest into this film. It's definitely like got his kind of, you know, his stamp on it, which again, like I just really appreciate that this is a filmmaker who's, you know, responsible for one of the kind of biggest action sci-fi franchises of all time, but also just brought us Babe and Happy Feet at the same time. It's just nobody is doing it like George Miller.
Yeah, and it's always good with Film Club when we look back at these films to just remember that the past is definitely a different country. The 90s did have this period where these maverick filmmakers like a Terry Gilliam or a Tim Burton would be given the reins of quite mainstream, big budgeted pictures. This was $90 million, I think, for George Miller. And yeah, whether it has aged badly, as you say, Layla, or whether some elements are quite macabre now to watch, you will never be mistaken, you know, that there's a director behind the camera, whereas with some new films now for kids or for families, it can be anonymously directed, or they find their personality in a sort of timing of dialogue or sense of humor. So the fact that he is visually throwing his camera around and creating studio-bound kind of magic of the old style is really something, but also so weird as well that at the end of this dark, twisted pseudo fairy tale of the marginalized animals all coming together and rising up, you then fade to black for the credits, and in comes Peter Gabriel singing a song written by Randy Newman, which is the most 90s thing way that it could wrap up. So Hannah, would you recommend going and watching Babe as well? How does this rank next to Babe if you're a Babe fan?
Yeah, it can't compare to Babe, because Babe is just like, you know, it is an absolute Stone Cold classic, and still kind of Farmer Hoggett singing to Babe with him like wrapped in the blanket when he's got when he's not very well and they think he's going to die is just one of the sweetest things I have ever seen. And I do kind of tear up a bit whenever I hear If I Had Words, which is the little song that they sing throughout Babe, Babe Pig in the Sea. But I definitely, yeah, I would recommend people watch Babe Pig in the City, if purely because it is just a fascinating relic to a completely different time in Hollywood.
And it's good seeing an ambitious filmmaker torpedoing their career. University of Wild on release. I think only Gene Siskel is the only person that liked it at the time, but it's got a bit...
Taste, right there.
Got a bit more love now. Layla, will you be showing this one to your kids?
I tried to show this one to my kids. They had zero interest in it at all. I might as well have had static on for all that they were kind of looking at the screen. Yeah, I'd just say watch Babe twice.
Perfect. Well, listeners, that's Babe, Pig in the City, wrapping up this week's episode. So let us know what you think of that film, if you've watched it, or any of the other films we've talked about this week, at the usual channels, at LWLIs on Twitter, Truth and Movies at tcolondon.com via email. Before we wrap up, Layla, I believe that there's another film out this week, After Love, that you're a fan of. Do you want to give a quick plug to that one?
Oh, yeah, I'm a big fan of that. Yes, no, please go and see that. Aleem Khan, it's his first feature. It's a wonderful story about a woman called Mary whose husband dies. And then after his death, she kind of uncovers some secrets about him. And she kind of goes off on a quest to, you know, find out the truth about the man that she spent her life with. It's really wonderful. It's got beautiful performances. And yeah, I think it would be gorgeous on a big screen.
So there's a bonus recommendation there for After Love in cinemas this weekend as well. Next week, we're talking about the Oscar-winning film The Father, Shiver Baby, and in Film Club, it's 25th anniversary of the Coen brothers' film Fargo. So let us know what you make of Fargo, and we can maybe read out some comments on air if you send them in at LWIs or truthandmovies at tcolondon.com. Hannah, Layla, thank you so much for joining me this week. Listeners, please subscribe wherever you pod. If your podcast player of choice also lets you leave reviews, we'd love it if you leave one for us too. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.